Majka. After shaving, he dried himself and dressed in haste. He took out one of the two metal boxes he kept in the safe and opened it. A Lama Minimax subcompact, which could hold 7 bullets, 6 in the magazine plus 1 in the chamber. He disassembled the weapon and divided the parts into the 4 small, purpose-designed hiding places under the reinforced corners of the suitcase. If customs officers stopped him and checked his suitcase, the reinforced metal pieces would hide the gun parts. Before leaving, he checked that he had his passport and the envelope with the ticket that she had given him, the photograph of the target, and the information he needed for when and where. It was due to happen tomorrow night at 7 in a public place. She had told him this job was riskier than the previous one. Nevertheless, he was not afraid. Now and then he wondered whether the ability to be afraid had been lost, along with his father's amputated arm that night. Bobo had said, "You cannot survive for long if you are not frightened." Outside, Zagreb had just woken up, snow-free, grey with mist, its face drawn and haggard. He stood in front of the hotel entrance, thinking that in a few days' time they would be going to the Adriatic, a little place with a little hotel, off-peak prices and a bit of sun, and talking about the new house. The bus to the airport should have been here by now. He peered into the mist, the way he had that autumn, crouching beside Bobo and trying in vain to see something behind the white smoke. His job had been to run messages they didn't dare send over the radio link, as the Serbs were tuned to the frequency and didn't miss a thing. And since he was so small, he could run through the trenches at full speed without having to duck. He had told Bobo he wanted to attack tanks. Bobo had shaken his head. "You're a messenger. These messages are important, Sonny. I've got men to take care of the tanks."
"But they're frightened. I'm not frightened."
Bobo had raised an eyebrow. "You're only a little kid.
If bullets find me here rather than out there, I don't get any older. And you said yourself that if we don't stop the tanks, they'll take the town."
Bobo had given him a searching look. "Let me think about it," he said in the end. So they had sat in silence, scanning the white screen without being able to distinguish between autumn mist and smoke from the ruins of the burning town. Then Bobo had cleared his throat. "Last night I sent Franjo and Mirko to the gap in the embankment where the tanks come out. The mission was to hide and attach mines to the tanks as they rolled past. You know how that worked out?" He had nodded again. He had seen the bodies of Franjo and Mirko through the binoculars. "If they'd been smaller, they might have been able to hide in the hollows in the ground," Bobo said. The boy had wiped away the snot from under his nose with a hand.
"How do I fix the mines to the tanks?"
At the crack of dawn on the following day, he had wriggled back to his own lines, shaking with cold and covered in mud. Behind him, on the embankment, lay 2 destroyed Serbian tanks, with smoke belching out of the open hatches. Bobo had dragged him down into the trench and shouted in triumph, "To us a little redeemer is born!" And that same day, when Bobo had dictated the message to be radioed to HQ in the town, he was given the code name that would follow him until the Serbs occupied and razed his hometown to ashes, killing Bobo, massacring doctors and patients at the hospital, imprisoning and torturing any who offered resistance. It was a bitter paradox of a name, given to him by the one person he had not been able to save. Mali Spasite, the Little Redeemer. A red bus emerged out of the sea of mist. The meeting room in the red zone on the 6th floor buzzed with low conversation and muted laughter as Harry approached, and he saw that he had timed his arrival well. Too late to mingle, eat cake, and exchange the jokes and jibes with colleagues that men resort to when they have to say goodbye to someone they appreciate. On time for the presents and the speeches, laden with too many pompous words men feel emboldened to use when they are in front of an audience and not in private. Harry took stock of the crowd and found the 3 faces he could rely on to be friendly. His departing boss, Bjarne Müller, Officer Halvorsen, and Beate Lern. He did not make eye contact with anyone, and no one tried with him. Harry was under no illusions about his popularity in Crime Squad. Müller had once said there was only one thing people disliked more than a sullen alcoholic, and that was a tall, sullen alcoholic. Harry was 6 feet and 4 inches of sullen alcoholic, and the fact that he was a brilliant detective mildly worked in his favour, but no more than that. Everyone knew that, had it not been for Bjarne Møller's protective wing, Harry would have been off the force years ago. And now that Møller was going, everyone also knew that the top brass were just waiting for him to step out of line. Paradoxically, what was protecting him now was the same thing that stamped him as an eternal outsider. The fact that he had brought down one of their own. The Prince. Tom Wohler, an inspector in Crime Squad, one of the men behind the extensive gun-running operation in Oslo for the last 8 years. Tom Wohler had ended his days in a pool of blood in the basement of a residential apartment tower in Kampen. In a brief ceremony in the cafeteria 3 weeks later, the chief superintendent had, through clenched teeth, acknowledged Harry's contribution to cleaning up their own ranks, and Harry had thanked him. "Thank you," he had said, running his eyes across the assembled officers to check if anyone's met his. In fact, he had meant to restrict his speech to these two words, but the sight of averted faces and sardonic smiles had whipped up a sudden fury in him, and he had added, "I guess this will make it a little more difficult for someone to give me the boot now. The press might believe that the person in question is doing it out of fear that I will be after him as well." And then they had looked at him, in disbelief. He had continued, nevertheless. "No reason to gape, guys. Tom Wohler was an inspector with us in Crime Squad, and dependent on his position to do what he was doing. He called himself the Prince and, as you know..." Here Harry had paused, while his gaze moved from face to face, stopping at the chief superintendent's. "Where there's a prince, there's usually a king."
"Hello, old boy. Lost in thought?"
Harry looked up. It was Halvorsen.
"Thinking about kings," Harry mumbled, taking the cup of coffee that the young detective passed him.
"Well, there's the new guy,"
Halvorsen said, pointing. By the table of presents there was a man in a blue suit talking to the chief superintendent and Bjarne Müller.
"Is that Gunnar Hagen?" Harry said after taking a sip of coffee. "The new PAS.
They're not Politiavdelingschef anymore, Harry."
"No.
POB. Politoverbetjent. They changed the names of the ranks more than 4 months ago."
"Is that so? I must have been sick that day."
"Are you still a police officer?"
Halvorsen smiled. The new POB seemed agile and younger than the 53 years it said he was in the memo. More medium-tall than tall, Harry noticed, and lean. The network of defined muscles in his face, around the jaw and down his neck, suggested an ascetic lifestyle. His mouth was straight and firm, and his chin stuck out in a way you could designate either determined or protruding. The little hair Hagen had was black and formed half a wreath around his pate. However, it was so thick and compact, you might be forgiven for thinking the new POB had a rather eccentric choice of hairstyle. At any rate, the enormous demonic eyebrows boded well for the growing conditions of his body hair.
"Straight from the military," Harry said. "Perhaps he'll introduce Reveille."
"He was supposed to have been a good cop before switching pastures."
"Judging from what he wrote about himself in the memo, you mean."
"Nice to hear you being so positive, Harry."
"Me? I'm always anxious to give new people a fair chance."
"A being the operative word,"
Beata said, joining them. She flicked her short blonde hair to the side.
"I thought I saw you limping as you came in, Harry."
"Met an overexcited guard dog down at the container terminal last night."
"What were you doing there?"
Harry studied Beata before answering. The job of head at Brinsaleen had been good for her, and it had been good for Krimtechnisch too. Beata had always been a competent professional, but Harry had to admit he hadn't seen obvious leadership qualities in the self-effacing, shy young girl when she joined the robberies unit after police training college. "Wanted to take a look at the container where Per Holman was found.
Tell me, how did he get into the area?"
"Cut the lock with wire cutters.
They were beside him."
"And you? How did you get in?"
"What else did you find?"
"Harry, there is no suggestion that this is..."
"I'm not saying there is. What else?"
"What do you think?"
"Tools of the trade? A dose of heroin and a plastic bag containing tobacco. You know, they poke the tobacco out of the butts they pick up. And not one krona, of course."
"And the Beretta?"
The serial number has been removed, but the fire marks are familiar. A gun from the days of the prince.
Harry had noticed that Beata refused to let the name Tom Vola pass her lips.
Have the results for the blood sample arrived?
Yep,
she said. Surprisingly clean. Hadn't shot up recently anyway. So conscious and capable of killing himself. Why do you ask?
I had the pleasure of communicating the news to the parents.
Oh,
Lern and Halverson said in unison. It was happening more and more often, even though they had been a couple for just 2 years. The chief superintendent coughed, and the gathering turned toward the table of presents as the chatter subsided.
Biana has requested permission to say a word or two, the chief superintendent said, rocking on his heels and pausing for effect, and permission was granted.
Chuckles all around. Harry noticed Bjarne Müller's tentative smile in the direction of his superior officer.
Thank you, Torleif, and thank you and the chief constable for my farewell present, and a special thank you to all of you for the wonderful picture you have given me.
He pointed to the table.
Everyone?
Harry whispered to Beata.
Yes, Skara and a couple of others collected the money.
I didn't hear anything about that.
They might have forgotten to ask you.
Now I'll distribute a few presents of my own, Merla said, from the deceased's estate, so to speak. First of all, there is this magnifying glass.
He held it up in front of his face, and the others laughed at the ex-PAS's distorted features.
This goes to a girl who is every bit as good a detective and police officer as her father was, who never takes the credit for her work, but prefers to let us shine in Crime Squad. As you know, she has been the subject of research by brain specialists, and she is blessed with the very rare fusiform gyrus, which allows her to remember every single face she has seen.
Harry saw Beata blush. She didn't like the attention, least of all concerning this exceptional skill, which meant she was still being used to identify grainy images of ex-cons on bank robbery videos.
I hope that you won't forget this face, Müller said, even though you won't see it for a while. And if you have cause to doubt, you can use this.
Halvorsen nudged Beata in the back. When Merle gave her a hug, as well as the magnifying glass, and the audience applauded, even her forehead went a fiery red.
The next heirloom is my office chair, Bjarne said. You see, I found out that my successor, Gunnar Hagen, has put in for a new one in black leather, with a high back and other features.
Merle sent a smile to Hagen, who did not return it, but gave a brief nod.
The chair goes to an officer from Steinscher who, ever since he came here, has been banished to an office with the biggest troublemaker in the building, and forced to sit on a defective chair. Junior, I think it's time.
Yippee,
Halvorsen said. Everyone turned and laughed, and Halvorsen laughed in return.
And, to conclude, a technical aid for someone who is very special to me. He has been my best investigator and my worst nightmare. To the man who always follows his nose, his own agenda, and, unhappily for those of us who try to get you to turn up on time for morning meetings, his own watch.
Merle took a wristwatch from his jacket pocket.
I hope this will make you work in the same time frame as the others do.
Anyway, I have more or less set it to Crime Squad clocks, and well, there was a lot between the lines there, Harry.
Scattered applause, as Harry went forward to receive the watch with a plain black leather strap. The brand was unfamiliar to him.
Thanks,
Harry said. The two tall men embraced.
I put it 2 minutes fast, so that you're in time for what you thought you would miss,
Merle whispered.
No more warnings. Do what you have to.
Thanks,
Harry repeated, thinking Merle was holding him for a bit too long. He reminded himself he had to leave the present he had brought with him from home. Fortunately, he had never got around to ripping off the plastic cover of All About Eve.
5. Monday, December 15th. The Lighthouse. John found Robert in the backyard of Freitex, the Salvation Army shop on Kirkeveien. He was leaning against the doorframe with his arms crossed, watching the guys carrying garbage bags from the truck into the shop's storeroom. They were blowing white speech bubbles, which they filled with swear words in a variety of dialects and languages.
Good catch,
John asked. Robert shrugged. People happily give away their whole summer wardrobe so that they can buy new clothes next year. But it's winter clothes we need now. Your guys use colourful language. Paragraph 12 types. Doing social work instead of prison. I counted up yesterday. We've now got twice as many volunteers doing a stretch as we have people who have turned to Jesus. John smiled. Untilled fields for missionaries. Just a question of getting started. Robert called to one of the guys who threw him a pack of cigarettes. Robert put a coffin nail between his lips. No filter. Take it out, John said. Soldier's vows. You could be dismissed. I wasn't thinking of lighting it, bro. What do you want? John shrugged. To talk. What about? John chuckled. It's normal for brothers to talk now and then. Robert nodded and picked flakes of tobacco off his tongue. When you say talk, you usually mean you're going to tell me how to lead my life. Come on. What is it, then? Nothing. I was wondering how you were. Robert took out the cigarette and spat in the snow. Then he peered up into the high white cloud cover. I'm fucking sick of this job. I'm fucking sick of the flat. I'm fucking sick of the shriveled-up, hypocritical sergeant major running the show here. If she weren't so ugly, I would... Robert grinned. Fuck the old prune-faced stupid. I'm freezing. John said. Can we go in? Robert walked ahead into the tiny office and sat on a chair squeezed between a cluttered desk, a narrow window with a view of the backyard, and a red and yellow flag with the Salvation Army's emblem and motto, Blood and Fire. John lifted a heap of papers, some yellowing with age, off a wooden chair he knew Robert had pinched from the Meyerstuen Corps' room next door. She says you're a malingerer, John said. Who? Sergeant Major Ruhr. John grimaced. Pruneface. So she called you. Is that how it is? Robert poked around in the desk with his pocket knife, then burst out, Oh yes, I forgot. You're the new admin boss, the boss of the whole shebang. No decision has been made yet. It might well be Rickard. Whatever. Robert carved two semicircles in the desk to form a heart. You've said what you came to say. Before you get lost, can I have the 500 for your shift tomorrow? John took the money from his wallet and laid it on the desk in front of his brother. Robert stroked the blade of the knife against his chin. The black bristles rasped. And I'll remind you of one more thing. John knew what was coming and swallowed. And what's that? Over Robert's shoulder, he could see it had begun to snow. But the rising heat from the houses around the backyard made the flimsy white flakes stand still in the air outside the window, as though listening. Robert placed the point of the knife in the center of the heart. If I find you even once in the vicinity of you-know-who. He put his hand around the shaft of the knife and leaned forward. His body weight forced the blade into the dry wood with a crunch. I'll destroy you, John. I swear I will. Am I interrupting? Came a voice from the door. Not at all, Fru Ruhr, Robert said as sweet as pie. My brother was just about to leave. The chief superintendent and the new POB, Gunnar Hagen, stopped talking when Bjarne Müller came into his office, which of course was no longer his. Well, do you like the view? Müller asked in what he hoped was a cheery tone, and added, Gunnar. The name felt strange on his tongue. Oslo is always a sad sight in December, Gunnar Hagen said, but we'll have to see whether we can sort that out too. Müller felt an urge to ask what he meant by too, but stopped when he saw the chief superintendent give a nod of approval. I was giving Gunnar the lowdown on the people around here, in all confidence, you understand. Ah, yes. You two know each other from before. Yes, indeed, said the chief superintendent. Gunnar and I have known each other ever since we were cadets at what used to be called police school. It's said in the memo that you do the Birkebeiner race every year, Müller said, turning to Gunnar Hagen. Did you know that the chief superintendent does too? Oh, yes, indeed. Hagen looked over at the chief superintendent with a smile. Sometimes Torleif and I go together and try to outdo each other in the final spurt. Well, what do you know? Müller said, amused. So if the chief had been on the appointment board, he could have been accused of cronyism. The chief superintendent gave a dry chuckle and shot an admonitory glance at Bjarne Müller. I was telling Gunnar about the man you so generously presented with a watch. Harry Hole. Yes, Gunnar Hagen said.
I know he's the man who killed an inspector in connection with that stupid smuggling business. Tore the man's arm off in an elevator, I heard. And now he's also under suspicion of leaking the case to the press. Not good. First of all, the stupid smuggling business was a gang of pros, with offshoots in the police, who flooded Oslo with cheap handguns for years, Bjarne Møller said, trying in vain to keep the irritation out of his voice. A case that whole, despite the resistance here in HQ, solved unaided, thanks to many years of painstaking police work. Second, he killed Vola in self-defense, and it was the elevator that tore off his arm. And third, we have no evidence whatsoever regarding who leaked what. Gunnar Hagen and the chief superintendent exchanged glances. Be that as it may, the chief superintendent said, he's someone you'll have to keep an eye on, Gunnar. From what I gather, his girlfriend left him recently. And we know that men with Harry's bad habits are extra susceptible to relapses, which of course we cannot accept, however many cases he's solved in this unit. I'll keep him in line, Hagen said. He's an inspector, Merla said, closing his eyes. Not rank and file. Not very big on being kept in line either. Gunnar Hagen nodded slowly as his hand went up through his thick wreath of hair. When is it you begin in Bergen? Hagen lowered his hand. Bjarne. Merla guessed his name sounded just as strange on the other man's tongue. Harry wandered down Urtegata and could see by the footwear of the people he met that he was getting close to the lighthouse. The guys in narcotics used to say that no one did more for the identification of addicts than the Army-Navy surplus stores, because sooner or later, military footwear ended up on junkies' feet via the Salvation Army. In the summer, it was blue sneakers. In the winter, like now, the junkies' uniform was black military boots, together with a green plastic bag containing a Salvation Army-packed lunch. Harry swung through the door with a nod to the guard wearing the Salvation Army hoodie. Anything? The guard asked. Harry patted his pockets. Nothing. A sign on the wall said all alcohol had to be handed in at the door and given back when leaving. Harry knew they had given up on drugs and the equipment. No junkie would hand that in. Harry entered, poured himself a cup of coffee and sat on the bench by the wall. Fearlisa, the lighthouse, was the Army's cafe, the new millennium's version of the soup kitchen, where the needy were given free snacks and coffee. A cozy, well-lit room. The only difference between this and the usual cappuccino bar was the clientele. 90% of drug users were male. They ate slices of white bread with Norwegian brown or white cheese, read the newspapers, and had quiet conversations around the tables. It was a free zone, a chance to thaw out and take a breather from the search for the day's fix. Although undercover police dropped by now and again, there was a tacit agreement that no arrests would be made inside. A man sitting next to Harry had frozen into a deep bow. His head hung down over the table, and in front of him, black fingers held a cigarette paper. There were a few butts scattered around. Harry noticed the uniformed back of a mini-woman changing burned-down candles on a table with four picture frames. Inside three of them were individual photographs. Inside the fourth was a cross and a name on a white background. Harry stood up and walked over. "What are they?" he asked. Perhaps it was the slim neck or the grace of the movement, or the smooth raven-black, almost unnatural, shiny hair that made Harry think of a cat even before she had turned around. The impression was reinforced by the small face with the disproportionately broad mouth and the pertest of noses possible, like those the characters in Harry's Japanese comics had. But, more than anything else, it was the eyes. He couldn't put his finger on why, but something about them was not right. "November," she answered. She had a calm, deep, gentle alto voice that made Harry wonder if it was natural, or a way of speaking she had acquired. He had known women who did that, who changed their voices the way they changed clothes. One voice for home use, one for first impressions and social occasions, and one for nighttime intimacies.
"What do you mean?" Harry asked.
"A November crop of deaths." Harry looked at the photos and he realized what she meant.
"Four," he said in a low voice.
In front of the pictures was a letter written with an unsteady hand in penciled capitals. On average, one customer dies a week. Four is not out of the ordinary. Our Remembrance Day is on the first Wednesday of every month. Is there anyone you...
Harry shook his head. My dearest Gaia, the letter began. No flowers.
Is there anything I can help you with?
She asked. It struck Harry that she may not have had any other voices in her repertoire, just this deep, warm tone.
Per Holman, Harry started, not knowing quite how to finish. Poor Per, yes.
We'll have a Remembrance Day for him in January. Harry nodded. First Wednesday.
That's it.
And you're very welcome to come, brother.
This brother was enunciated with such unforced ease, like an underplayed and hence almost unarticulated appendix to the sentence. For a moment, Harry almost believed her.
I'm a detective, Harry said.
The difference in height between them was so great that she had to crane her neck to see him clearly.
I've seen you before, I think, but it must be years ago.
Harry nodded.
Maybe. I've been here once or twice, but I haven't seen you.
I'm part-time here. Otherwise, I'm at the Salvation Army headquarters. And you work in the drugs division?
Harry shook his head. Murder investigations.
Murder?
But Per wasn't murdered. Can we sit down for a moment? She hesitated and looked around.
Busy? Harry asked.
Not at all. It's unusually quiet. On a normal day, we serve 1,800 slices of bread. But today's dole day.
She called one of the boys behind the counter, who agreed to take over. Harry caught her name at the same time. Martina. The head of the man with the empty cigarette paper had been ratcheted down a few more notches.
There are a couple of things that don't check out, Harry said after sitting down.
What sort of person was he?
Hard to say, she said. Harry's quizzical expression produced a sigh. When you've been on drugs for so many years, like Bear, the brain is so destroyed that it's hard to see a personality. The urge to get high is all-pervasive.
I know that, but I mean, to people who knew him well.
Can't help, I'm afraid. You can ask Per's father how much of his son's personality was left. He came down here a couple of times to collect him. In the end, he gave up. He said Per had started to threaten them at home, because they locked away all their valuables when he was around. He asked me to keep an eye on the boy. I said we would do our best, but we couldn't promise miracles. And we didn't, of course.
Harry observed her. Her face expressed nothing more than the usual social worker's resignation.
It must be hell, Harry said, scratching his leg.
Yes. You have to be an addict yourself to understand it.
To be a parent, I was thinking.
Martina didn't answer. A man in a torn quilted jacket had come to the neighboring table. He opened a transparent plastic bag and emptied out a pile of dry tobacco that must have come from hundreds of cigarette butts. It covered the cigarette paper and the black fingers of the man sitting there.
Merry Christmas,
the man mumbled, and departed with a junkie's old man gait.
What doesn't check out?
Martina asked.
The blood specimen shows almost no toxins, Harry said.
So?
Harry looked at the man next to him. He was desperately trying to roll a cigarette, but his fingers would not obey.
A tear ran down his brown cheek.
I know a couple of things about getting high, Harry said. Do you know if he owed money to anyone?
No.
Her answer was curt, so much so that Harry already knew the answer to his next question. But you could, maybe.
No,
she interrupted.
I cannot make inquiries.
Listen, these are people no one cares about, and I am here to help them, not to persecute them.
Harry gave her a searching look.
You're right. I apologize for asking, and it won't happen again.
Thank you.
Just one last question.
Come on.
Would you... Harry hesitated, wondering if he was about to commit a blunder. Would you believe me if I said I did care?
She angled her head and studied Harry.
Should I?
Well, I'm investigating a case everyone thinks is the cut-and-dried suicide of a person no one cared about.
She didn't answer.
It's good coffee.
Harry got up.
You're welcome, she said.
And may God bless you.
Thank you, Harry said, feeling to his surprise the lobes of his ears flush.
On his way out, he stopped in front of the guard in the hoodie and turned, but she had gone.
The man offered Harry the green plastic bag with the packed lunch.
but he turned it down, pulled his coat tighter around him, and went out into the streets, where he could already see the sun making its blushing retreat into the Oslo fjord. He walked down the Akerselva. In the area known as Eika, a man was standing erect in a snowdrift, with the sleeve of a quilted jacket rolled up, and a needle hanging from his forearm. He smiled as he looked straight through Harry and the frosty mist over Grönland. 6. Monday, December 15th. Halvorsen. Bernille Holmen seemed even smaller, sitting in her armchair on Fredensborgveien, her large red-rimmed eyes staring at Harry. In her lap she held a glass-framed photograph of her son.
"He was 9 here,"
she said. Harry had to swallow, partly because no smiling 9-year-old in a life jacket looks as if he imagines he will end up in a container with a bullet through his head, and partly because the photo reminded him of Oleg, who could forget himself and call Harry Papa. Harry wondered how long it would take him to call Matthias Lund Helgeson Papa.
"Birger, my husband, used to go out in search of Per if he had been missing for a few days," she said, "even though I asked him to stop. I couldn't stand having Per here any longer."
Harry repressed his thought. Why not? Birger Holmen was at the undertaker's, she had explained, when Harry came by unannounced. She sniffled.
"Have you ever shared a house with someone who has an addiction?"
Harry didn't answer.
"He stole everything in sight. We accepted it. That is, Birger accepted it. He's the loving one of us, too."
She pulled her face into a grimace, which Harry interpreted as a smile.
"He defended Per in everything. Right up to this autumn, until Per threatened me."
"Threatened you?"
"Yes. Threatened to kill me."
She looked down at the photo and rubbed the glass as though it had become unclear.
"Per rang the bell one morning, and I refused to let him in. I was on my own. He wept and begged, but we had played that game before, so I was hard. I went back into the kitchen and sat down. I don't know how he got in, but all of a sudden there he was, standing in front of me with a gun."
"The same gun he—"
"Yes. Yes, I think so."
"Go on."
"He forced me to unlock the cupboard where I kept my jewelry. That is, the little I had left. He had already taken most of it. Then he was off."
"And you?"
"Me? I had a breakdown. Birger came and took me to hospital."
She sniffled.
"Well, they wouldn't even give me any more pills. They said I'd had enough."
"What kind of pills were they?"
"What do you think? Tranquilizers. Enough, when you have a son who keeps you awake at night because you're frightened he'll return."
She paused and pressed a clenched fist against her mouth. Tears were in her eyes. Then she whispered in such a low voice that Harry struggled to catch the words,
"Sometimes you don't want to live any longer."
Harry cast his eyes down to his notepad. It was blank.
"Thank you,"
he said.
"One night, sir? Is that correct?"
asked the female receptionist at the Scandia Hotel by Oslo Central Station, without looking up from the reservation on the computer screen.
"Yes,"
the man before her answered. She had made a mental note that he was wearing a light brown coat, camel hair, or imitation. Her long red nails scurried across the keyboard like frightened cockroaches. Imitation camels in wintry Norway. Why not? She had seen pictures of camels in Afghanistan, and her boyfriend had written that it could be just as cold there as here.
"Will you be paying by cash or credit card, sir?"
"Cash."
She pushed the registration form and a pen over the counter to him and asked to see his passport.
"No need," he answered. "I'll pay now."
He spoke English almost like a Brit, but there was something about the way he articulated consonants that made her think of Eastern Europe.
"I still have to see your passport, sir. International regulations."
He nodded in acknowledgement, passed her a smooth 1,000-kroner note and his passport.
"Republika Hrvatska?"
Probably one of the new countries in the East. She gave him his change, put the note in the cash box, and reminded herself to check it against the light when the hotel guest had gone. She endeavored to maintain a certain style, although she had to concede that, for the moment, she was working at one of the city's less sophisticated hotels. And this particular guest did not look like a swindler, more like a, well, what did he look like, in fact?
She gave him the plastic card and the spiel about floor, elevator, breakfast, and checkout times. "Will there be anything else, sir?" she warbled, confident that her English and service attitude were too good for this hotel. Before very long she would move to somewhere better, or, if that was not possible, trim her approach. He cleared his throat and asked where the nearest telephone booth was. She explained that he could call from his room, but he shook his head. She had to think. The rise in cell phone use had meant that most phone booths in Oslo had been removed, but she thought there was still one close by, in Jernbanetorget, the square outside the station. Although it was only 100 yards away, she took out a little map, marked it, and gave him directions, as they did in the Radisson and Choice hotels. Peering up to see whether he had understood, she was confused for a moment, without quite knowing why.
"It's us against the rest of the world, Halvorsen," Harry shouted his regular morning greeting as he burst into their shared office.
"Two messages," Halvorsen said.
"You've got to report to the new POB's office, and a woman called asking for you.
Stunning voice."
"Oh?"
Harry slung his coat in the direction of the coat rack. It landed on the floor.
"Wow," Halvorsen exclaimed without thinking. "At last you're over it, aren't you?"
"I beg your pardon."
"You're chucking clothes at the coat rack again and saying, 'It's us against the rest of the world.' You haven't done either since Raquel dumped—"
Halvorsen shut up as he saw his colleague's warning expression. "What did the lady want?"
"To pass on a message. Her name is—"
Halvorsen searched through the yellow post-its in front of him.
"Martina Eckhoff."
"Don't know her."
"Works at the lighthouse."
"Aha!
She said she'd been making inquiries, and that no one had heard anything about Per Holman having any debts."
"Hmm. Perhaps I should call and check if there was anything else."
"Oh, okay. Fine."
"All right. Why are you looking so cheated?"
Harry bent down for his coat, but instead of hanging it up, he put it on.
"Do you know what, Junior? I have to go out again."
"But the POB
will have to wait."
The gate to the container terminal was open, but there was a sign on the fence prohibiting access and directing vehicles to the parking lot outside. Harry scratched his bad leg, glanced at the long open expanse between the containers, and drove in. The watchman's office was a low building much like a workman's shed that had been extended at regular intervals over the last 30 years, which was not that far from the truth. Harry parked in front of the entrance and covered the remaining yards at a quick walk. The watchman leaned back in his chair, silent, his hands behind his head, chewing on a matchstick, while Harry explained why he was there, and what had happened the night before. The matchstick was the only thing moving in the watchman's face, but Harry thought he detected the hint of a grin as he told him about the altercation with the dog.
"Black Metzner," the watchman said, "a cousin of the Rhodesian Ridgeback. Lucky to get it imported. Great guard dog, and quiet too."
"I noticed."
The matchstick jumped in amusement. "The Metzner is a hunter, so it sneaks up. Doesn't want to frighten the prey."
"Are you saying the animal intended to, eat me?"
"Depends what you mean by eat."
The watchman did not go into any details, just stared at Harry with a blank expression. The interwoven hands framed the whole of his head, and Harry was thinking that he had either unusually big hands or an unusually small head. "So, you didn't see or hear anyone at the time we are assuming Per Holman was shot?"
"Was shot?"
"Shot himself."
"Anything?" "Guard stays indoors in the winter, and a Metzner is quiet, as I said."
"Isn't that impractical? That it doesn't raise an alarm, I mean."
The watchman shrugged. "It gets the job done, and we don't have to go out."
"It didn't catch Per Holman when he slipped in."
"It's a big area. But later." "The body, you mean? That was frozen, wasn't it? And the Metzner's not so crazy about dead things. It likes fresh meat."
Harry shuddered. "In the police report, it says you'd never seen Holman down here before."
"That's right.
I've just been to see his mother, and she lent me this family photo."
Harry put the picture on the watchman's desk.
"Could you take a look and swear to me that you have never seen this person before?"
The watchman lowered his gaze, rolled the matchstick to the corner of his mouth to answer, then paused. The hands moved from behind his head and he picked up the photo, studied it at length.
"I made a mistake. I have seen him. He was here in the summer. It wasn't so easy to recognise the... what was in the container.
I can appreciate that. When Harry went to leave a few minutes later, he opened the door a crack at first and checked. The watchman grinned.
It's locked up during the day. And anyway, a Metzner's teeth are narrow. The wound heals fast. I've been thinking about buying a Kentucky Terrier. Jagged teeth. Bites chunks out of you. You were lucky, Inspector.
Well, Harry said, you'd better warn Fido that a lady is on her way, and she'll give him something else to bite.
What?
Halverson asked, carefully manoeuvring the car past a snowplough.
Something soft, Harry said. Kind of clay. Afterward, Beata and her team will put the clay in plaster, let it set, and bingo, you've got a model of a dog's jaw.
Right. And that's supposed to prove that Per Holman was murdered?
No. I said that's what I need to prove that it was murder. The missing link in the chain of evidence.
I see. And what are the other links?
The usual. Motive, murder weapon, and opportunity. Turn right here.
I don't know. You said your suspicions were based on Holman using wire cutters to break into the container terminal?
I said that was what made me wonder. To be precise, I wondered how a heroin addict, so out of his skull that he has to look for refuge in a container, would be alert enough to make sure he had wire cutters to get through the gate. Then I had a closer look at the case. You can park here.
What I don't understand is how you can claim that you know who the guilty party is.
Work it out, Halverson. It's not difficult, and you have all the facts.
I hate it when you do this.
I only want you to be good. Halverson cast a glance at his older colleague to see if he was joking. They got out of the car. Aren't you going to lock up? Harry asked.
The lock froze last night. The key broke in it this morning.
How long have you known who the guilty person is?
A while.
They crossed the street.
Knowing who is, in most cases, the easy part. It's the obvious candidate, the husband, the best friend, the guy with a record, and never the butler. That's not the problem. The problem is proving what your head and your gut have been telling you for ages.
Harry pressed the bell beside Holman. And that's what we're going to do now. Find the little piece that changes apparently unconnected information into a perfect chain of evidence.
A voice crackled, "Ja?" over the speaker.
Police here, Harry Hall. Can we...
The lock buzzed.
It's all a question of moving fast, Harry said. Most murder cases are solved in the first 24 hours or not at all.
Thanks, I've heard that one before,
Halverson said.
Birger Holman stood waiting for them at the top of the stairs.
Come in, he said, and led them into the living room.
A bare Christmas tree stood by the door to the French balcony, waiting to be decorated.
My wife is sleeping, he said before Harry could ask.
We'll whisper,
Harry said.
Birger Holman gave a sad smile.
She won't wake up.
Halverson sent Harry a quick glance. The inspector said.
Taken a tranquilizer.
Birger Holman nodded.
The funeral's tomorrow.
Yes, of course. That's a strain.
Well, thank you for lending me this.
Harry put a photograph on the table. It was of Per Holman seated, with his mother and father standing on either side. Protected. Or, depending on how you saw it, surrounded. A silence ensued as no one said a word.
Birger Holman scratched his forearm through his shirt.
Halverson wriggled forward in his chair, then moved back.
Do you know much about drug addiction, Herr Holman?
Harry asked without looking up.
Birger Holman frowned.
My wife has taken one sleeping pill.
That doesn't mean I'm not talking about your wife.
You may be able to save her.
I'm talking about your son.
Depends what you mean by no. He was hooked on heroin. It made him unhappy.
He was going to say something else, but paused. He examined the picture on the table.
It made us all unhappy.
I don't doubt that, but if you had known anything about drug addiction, you would have known that it takes precedence over everything else.
Birger Holman's voice trembled with indignation.
Are you saying I don't know that, Inspector? Are you saying my wife was... he...
But tears had crept into his voice.
His own mother.
I know, Harry whispered, but drugs come before mothers, before fathers.
before life.
Harry breathed in, and before death.
I'm exhausted, Inspector. What do you want?
Tests show there were no drugs in his blood when he died, so he was in a bad state. And when heroin addicts are like this, the need for redemption is so strong that you can threaten your own mother with a gun to get it. And redemption is not a shot in the head, but in the arm, the neck, the groin, or any other place you can still find a fresh vein. Your son was found with his kit and a bag of heroin in his pocket, Herr Holman. He can't have shot himself. Drugs take precedence, as I said, over everything. Also, death. Birger Holman still had his head in his hands, but his voice was quite distinct.
So you think my son was killed? Why?
I was hoping you could tell us. Birger Holman did not answer.
Was it because he threatened her?
Harry asked. Was it to give your wife peace of mind? Holman raised his head.
What are you talking about?
My guess is you hung around Plata waiting, and when he turned up, you followed him after he had bought his fix. You took him down to the container terminal, as he sometimes went there when he had nowhere else.
How am I supposed to know that? This is outrageous.
Of course you knew. I showed this photo to the watchman, who recognized the person I was asking about.
Per?
No, you. You were there this summer asking if you could search the containers for your son. Holman stared at Harry, who went on. You had it all planned. Wire cutters to get in and an empty container, which was an appropriate place for a drug addict to end his life, where no one could hear or see you shoot him. With the gun you knew Per's mother could testify was his. Halvorsen studied Birger Holman and held himself in readiness, but Holman showed no signs of making any kind of move. He breathed heavily through his nose and scratched his forearm while staring into space.
You can't prove any of this.
He said this in a resigned tone, as if it were a fact he regretted. Harry made a conciliatory gesture. In the ensuing silence, they could hear loud barking from down in the street. It won't stop itching, will it? Harry said. Holman stopped scratching at once. Can we see what itches so much?
It's nothing.
We can do it here or down at the station. Your choice, Herr Holman. The barking increased in intensity. A dog sled, here, in the middle of the city. Halvorsen had a feeling there was going to be an explosion.
Fine,
Holman whispered, unbuttoning the cuff and pushing up his sleeve. There were two small sores with scabs on them. The skin around them was red and inflamed. Turn your arm around, Harry ordered. Holman had a matching sore underneath. They itch like hell, dog bites, don't they? Harry said, especially after 10 to 14 days when they begin to heal. A doctor down at the emergency room told me that I had to try to stop scratching. You should have done that too, Herr Holman. Holman gazed at his sores without seeing them.
I should have.
The skin is punctured in 3 places. We can prove that a particular dog down at the container terminal bit you. We have a model of its jaw. Hope you managed to defend yourself. Holman shook his head.
I didn't want to. I just wanted her to feel free.
The barking in the street came to a sudden end. Are you going to confess? Harry asked, signaling to Halvorsen, who thrust a hand into his inside pocket, without finding pen or paper. Harry rolled his eyes and gave him his own notepad.
He said he was so low, Holman said, that he couldn't go on, that now he really wanted to give up. So I searched around and found him a room at the Salvation Army hostel, a bed and 3 meals a day for 1,200 kroner a month, and he was promised a place in the methadone project. There was just a couple of months to wait. But then I heard nothing from him, and when I called the hostel, they said he had absconded without paying the rent and, well, then he turned up here again, with the gun.
And you decided then and there?
He was a goner. I had already lost my son, and I couldn't let him take her with him.
How did you find him?
Not in Plata. He was down in Eicher, and I said I would buy the gun off him. He was carrying it and showed it to me. Wanted the money on the spot, but I said I didn't have enough money. He should meet me at the gate at the back of the container terminal the next evening. You know, in fact, I'm glad you have...
How much? Harry interrupted.
What?
How much did you have to pay?
15,000 kroner.
And
he came.
It turned out he didn't have any ammunition for the weapon.
Never did, he said.
But you must have had an inkling that would be the case. And it's a standard caliber, so you bought some?
Yes.
Did you pay him first?
What?
Forget it. You have to understand it was only Pernilla and me who suffered. For Per, every day was a prolongation of his suffering. My son was a dead person waiting for someone to stop his heart that would not stop beating.
Redeemer?
Yes.
That's it. Redeemer.
But that's not your job, Herr Holman.
No, it's God's job.
Holman bowed his head and mumbled something.
What?
Asked Harry. Holman raised his head, but his eyes were staring into empty space.
If God doesn't do his job, though, someone else has to do it.
On the street, a brown dusk had descended around the yellow lights. Even in the middle of the Oslo night, the darkness was never total when snow had fallen. Noises were wrapped in cotton, and the creaking of snow underfoot sounded like distant fireworks.
Why don't we take him with us?
Halvorsen asked. He's not going anywhere. He has something to tell his wife. We'll send a car in a couple of hours.
Bit of an actor, isn't he?
Huh?
Well, wasn't he sobbing his guts out when you brought him the news of his son's death?
Harry shook his head in resignation.
You've got a lot to learn, Junior.
Annoyed, Halvorsen kicked at the snow.
Enlighten me, O wise one.
Committing a murder is such an extreme act that many repress it. They can walk around with it like a kind of half-forgotten nightmare. I have seen that several times now. It's when others say it out loud that they realize it is not just something that exists in their head. It did happen.
Right. A cold fish, anyway.
Didn't you see the man was crushed? Pernilla Holman was probably right when she said that her husband was the loving one.
Loving? A murderer?
Halvorsen's voice quivered with indignation. Harry laid a hand on the detective's shoulder.
Think about it. Isn't it the ultimate act of love? Sacrificing your only son?
But
I know what you're thinking, Halvorsen. But you'll just have to get used to the idea. This is the type of moral paradox that will fill your days. Halvorsen pulled at the unlocked car door, but it was frozen fast. In a sudden bout of fury, he heaved, and it came away from the rubber with a ripping noise. They got in, and Harry watched as Halvorsen twisted the ignition key and pinched his forehead hard with the other hand. The engine roared into life.
Halvorsen, Harry started.
Anyway, the case is solved and the POP is bound to be happy,
Halvorsen shouted, pulling out in front of a truck with its horn blaring. He held up an outstretched finger to the mirror.
So, let's smile and celebrate a little.
He lowered his hand and continued to pinch at his forehead.
Halvorsen.
What's up?
He barked. Park the car.
What?
Now. Halvorsen pulled over to the curb, let go of the steering wheel, and focused ahead through vacant eyes. In the time they had been with Holman, the ice flowers had crept up the windshield like a sudden attack of fungus. Halvorsen wheezed as his chest rose and fell.
Some days, this is a shit job, Harry said. Don't let it get to you.
No,
Halvorsen said, breathing even harder.
You are you, and they are them.
Yes.
Harry placed a hand on Halvorsen's back and waited. After a while, he felt his colleague's breathing calm down.
Tough guy, Harry said.
Neither of them spoke as the car crawled its way through the afternoon traffic toward Grönland. 7. Monday, December 15th. Anonymity. He stood at the highest point of Oslo's busiest pedestrian street, named after the Swedish-Norwegian king, Karl Johan. He had memorized the map he had been given at the hotel, and knew that the building he saw in silhouette to the west was the Royal Palace, and that Oslo's central station was at the eastern end. He shivered. High up a house wall, the sub-zero temperature shone out in red neon, and even the slightest current of air felt like an ice age penetrating his camel hair coat, which, until then, he had been very happy with. He had bought it in London for a song. The clock beside the temperature gauge showed 7 o'clock. He started walking east. The omens were good. It was dark. There were lots of people about, and the only surveillance cameras he saw were outside banks and directed at their respective cash machines. He had already excluded the subway for his getaway because of the combination of too many cameras and too few people. Oslo was smaller than he had imagined. He went into a clothing shop where he found a blue wool hat for 49 kroner and a wool jacket for 200, but changed his mind when he saw a thin raincoat for 120. While he was trying on the raincoat in a changing room, he discovered that the urinal blocks from Paris were still in his suit jacket pocket, crushed and ground into the material. The restaurant was several hundred yards down the pedestrian walkway, on the left-hand side. He registered at once that there was no cloakroom attendant. Good. That made things easier. He entered the dining area. Half full. Good sight lines. He could see all the tables from where he stood. A waiter came over and he reserved a window table for 6 o'clock the following day. Before leaving, he checked the bathroom. There were no windows, so the only other exit was through the kitchen. Okay. Nowhere was perfect, and it was improbable that he would need an alternative way out. He left the restaurant, looked at his watch, and started to walk toward the station. People avoided eye contact. A small town, but it still had the cool aloofness of a capital city. Good. He checked his watch again as he stood on the platform for the express train to the airport. 6 minutes from the restaurant. Trains left every 10 minutes and took 19. In other words, he could be on the train at 7:20 and in the airport by 7:40. The direct flight to Zagreb left at 9:10, and the ticket was in his pocket, bought on special offer from SAS. Satisfied, he walked out of the new rail terminal, down a staircase, under a glass roof that had obviously been the old departure hall, but where there were now shops, and out into the open square. Jernbanetorge, as it was called on the map. In the middle, there was a tiger, twice the size of life, frozen in mid-stride, between tram rails, cars, and people. But he couldn't see a phone booth anywhere, as the receptionist had said. At the end of the square, by a shelter, there was a throng of people. He went closer. Several of them had stuck their hoodie-covered heads together and were talking. Perhaps they came from the same place, or they were neighbors waiting for the same bus. It reminded him of something else, though. He spotted things changing hands, skinny men hurrying away with their backs bent into the freezing wind, and he knew what the things were. He had seen heroin deals taking place in Zagreb and other European towns, but nowhere as openly as here. Then he realized what it reminded him of, the gatherings of people he himself had been part of after the Serbians had withdrawn, refugees. Then a bus did come. It was white and stopped just short of the shelter. The doors opened, but no one got on. Instead, a young woman came out, wearing a uniform he recognized at once. The Salvation Army. He slowed down. She went over to one of the women and helped her onto the bus. Two men followed. He stopped and looked up. A coincidence, he thought. That was all. He turned around, and there at the bottom of a small clock tower he saw three telephones. 5 minutes later he had called Zagreb and told her everything was looking good. The final job, he had repeated, and Fred had told him that his Blue Lions, Dinamo Zagreb, were leading 1-0 against Rijeka at Maximar Stadium at half-time. The conversation had cost him 5 kroner. The clocks on the tower showed 7:25. The countdown had started. The group met in the hall belonging to Vestre Aker Church. The snowdrifts were high on both sides of the gravel path leading to the small brick building on the slope beside the cemetery. 14 people were seated in a bare meeting hall, with plastic chairs piled up against the walls and a long table in the middle. If you had stumbled into the room, you might have guessed it was a general assembly of some cooperative, but nothing about the faces, age, sex or clothes revealed what kind of community this was. The harsh light was reflected in the window panes and on the linoleum floor. There was a low mumbling and fidgeting with paper cups. A bottle of Faris mineral water hissed as it was opened. At 7 o'clock on the dot, the chattering stopped as a hand at the end of the table was raised and a little bell rang. Eyes turned to a woman in her mid-30s. She met them with a direct, fearless gaze. She had narrow, severe lips, softened with lipstick, long, thick, blonde hair held in place with a clip, and large hands that, at this moment, were resting on the table, exuding calm and confidence. She was elegant, meaning she had attractive features, but not the grace that would qualify her for what Norwegians termed sweet. Her body language betokened control and strength, which was underlined by the firm voice that filled the chilly room the next minute.
"Hi, my name is Astrid, and I'm an alcoholic."
"Hi, Astrid," the gathering answered in unison. Astrid bent the spine of the book in front of her and began to read.
"The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking,"
she went on, and around the table the lips of those who knew the 12 traditions moved by rote. In the breaks, when she paused for breath, you could hear the church choir practicing on the floor above.
"Today, the theme is the first step," Astrid said, "which runs thus. We admit we are powerless over alcohol, and that our lives have become unmanageable. I can begin, and I will be brief, since I consider myself finished with the first step."
She drew breath and gave a laconic smile.
"I've been dry for 7 years, and the first thing I do when I wake up is to tell myself I'm an alcoholic. My children don't know this. They think Mummy used to get very drunk and stop drinking because she got so angry when she drank. My life requires an appropriate measure of truth and an appropriate measure of lies to find its equilibrium. I may be going to pieces, but I take one day at a time and avoid the first drink, and at present I'm working on the 11th step. Thank you."
"Thank you, Astrid," came the response from the assembled members, followed by clapping as the choir sang its praises from the second floor. She nodded to her left, to a tall man with cropped blonde hair.
"Hi, my name is Harry," said the man in a gravelly voice.
The fine network of red veins on his large nose bore witness to a long life out of the ranks of the sober.
"I am an alcoholic."
"Hi, Harry.
I'm new here. This is my 6th meeting, or 7th, and I haven't finished the first step. In other words, I know I'm an alcoholic, but I think I can contain my alcoholism. So there is a kind of contradiction in my sitting here. But I came here because of a promise I made to a psychologist, a friend, who has my best interests at heart. He claimed that if I could stand all the chat about God and the spiritual stuff for the first weeks, I would find out it works. Well, I don't know if anonymous alcoholics can help themselves, but I am willing to try. Why not?"
He turned to the left to signal that he had finished. But before the clapping could get underway, it was interrupted by Astrid.
"This is the first time you've said anything at our meetings, Harry, so that's nice. But perhaps you'd like to tell us a little more while you're at it?"
Harry looked at her. The others did too, since pressuring anyone in the group was a clear breach of protocol. Her eyes held his. He had felt them on him in the earlier meetings, but had returned her gaze only once. However, then he had given her the full treatment, a searching look from top to toe and back again. Actually, he had liked what he saw, but what he liked best was when he returned to the top, and her face was a great deal redder, and at the next meeting he had been invisible.
"No, I wouldn't, thank you," Harry said.
Tentative applause. Harry observed her out of the corner of his eye, while his neighbor was talking. After the meeting, she asked him where he lived and offered him a lift. Harry hesitated while the choir on the floor above rose in pitch in their eulogy of the Lord. An hour and a half later, they were each smoking a cigarette in silence and watching the smoke add a blue tinge to the bedroom darkness. The damp sheets on Harry's narrow bed were still warm, but the cold in the room had made Astrid pull the thin white duvet right up to her chin.
"That was wonderful," she said.
Harry didn't answer. He was thinking it probably wasn't a question.
"I came," she said, "the first time together. That's not..."
"So your husband's a doctor," Harry said.
"That's the second time you've asked and the answer is still yes."
Harry nodded.
"Can you hear that sound?"
"Which sound?"
"The ticking. Is it your watch?"
"I don't have a watch." "It must be yours."
"Digital. Doesn't tick."
She placed a hand on his hip. Harry slipped out of bed. The freezing cold linoleum burned the soles of his feet.
"Would you like a glass of water?"
Harry went into the bathroom and looked into the mirror as he ran the water. What was it she had said? She could see loneliness in his eyes. He leaned forward, but all he could see was a blue iris around small pupils and deltas of veins in the whites. When Halvorsen found out he had split up with Raquel, He said Harry should find solace in other women, or, as he so poetically put it, screw the melancholy out of his soul. However, Harry had neither the energy nor the will, because he knew that any woman he touched would turn into Raquel. And that was what he needed to forget, to get her out of his blood, not some sexual methadone treatment. But he might have been wrong, and Halverson might have been right, because it had felt good. It had been wonderful. And instead of the empty feeling you got from trying to quench one desire by satisfying another, he felt his batteries recharged, and relaxed at the same time. She had taken what she needed, and he liked the way she had done it. Perhaps it could be as easy as this for him, too? He moved back a step and studied his body in the mirror. He had become leaner in the last year. There was less fat on him, but fewer muscles. He had begun to resemble his father, as one would expect. He went back to bed with a large glass, which they shared. Afterward, she snuggled up to him. Her skin was clammy and cold at first, but she soon began to warm him up.
"Now you can tell me," she said.
"Tell you what?"
Harry watched the smoke coil into a letter. "What's her name? Because it is a she, isn't it?"
The letter dissolved.
"She's the reason you came to us."
"Might be." Harry observed the glow eat away at the cigarette as he talked. A little, at first. The woman beside him was a stranger. It was dark, and the words rose and melted away. And he thought, this is what it must be like to sit in a confessional. To unburden yourself, or to share problems with others, as AA called it. So he continued. He told her about Raquel, who had thrown him out of the house over a year ago because she thought he was obsessed with the hunt for a mole in the police force, the prince, and about Oleg, her son, who had been snatched from his bedroom and used as a hostage when Harry finally got within shooting distance of the prince. Oleg had coped well, considering the circumstances of the kidnapping and the fact that he had witnessed Harry killing the kidnapper in an elevator in Kampen. It was worse for Raquel. 2 weeks later, when she was au fait with all the details, she had told him she could not have him in her life. Or, to be more precise, Oleg's life. Astrid nodded.
"She left you because of the harm you had done to them?"
Harry shook his head. "Because of the harm I had not done to them. Yet."
"Oh?"
"I said the case was closed, but she maintained I was obsessed, that it would never be closed as long as they were still out there." Harry stubbed his cigarette out in the ashtray on the bedside table. "And if it wasn't them, I would find others. Other people who could hurt them. She said she could not take that responsibility."
"Sounds like she's obsessed."
"No." Harry smiled. "She's right."
"Really? Would you care to amplify?"
Harry shrugged. "Submarines," he started, but was stopped by a violent coughing fit.
"What did you say about submarines?"
"She said that I was a submarine, going down into the cold, murky depths where you can't breathe, and coming up to the surface once every second month. She didn't want to keep me company down there. Reasonable enough."
"Do you still love her?"
Harry was not sure he liked the direction this problem-sharing was taking. He took a deep breath. In his head, he was playing the rest of the last conversation he'd had with Raquel. His own voice low, as it tends to be when he is angry or frightened. "Submarine."
"Raquel, I know it's not a very good image, but you understand."
Harry holds up his hands. "Of course. Excellent image. And what is this doctor? An aircraft carrier?" She groans.
"He has nothing to do with this, Harry. It's about you and me. And Oleg."
"Don't hide behind Oleg now."
"Hide?
You're using him as a hostage, Raquel."
"I'm using him as a hostage? Was it me who kidnapped Oleg and put a gun to his temple so that you could slake your thirst for revenge?"
The veins on her neck are standing out, and she screams so loud her voice becomes ugly. Someone else's. She hasn't the vocal cords to support such fury. Harry leaves and closes the door gently, almost without a sound, behind him. He turned to the woman in his bed. "Yes, I love her.